Okay, this is the third interview with Tim Frandy. We're here inside Memorial Library on the campus of UW-Madison. This interview is being done for what we call our Capital Protest 2011 Oral History Project. Today is October 21st, 2011, and my name is Troy Reeves. I head the UW-Madison Oral History Program. So Tim, as I said, when I had the recorder turned off, we just have a few more questions and then want to leave it open to you if you have things you want to say or maybe even reiterate from previous interviews. Mm-hmm. This is one of those questions I think we alluded to and you mentioned, but I think I want to ask it directly, and that's how did Facebook and other social media influence the protests?
Well, the two thoughts come to mind right away. And the first was, and I think we had actually talked about this last time, was the use of like Twitter and Facebook when we were trying to barricade doors, mm-hmm. which is a very short period of time, but it was a really effective way to communicate, because everyone had cell phones and you were living with your, you know, with your smartphones in the Capitol and, you know, using them to get out messaging and do that sort of work. So, you know, if you went to the Defend Wisconsin Twitter feed or the TAA Twitter feed, there would be, you know, lots of posts like, go to, you know, room 320 Northwest now and block the door. We need bodies. So that was important, you know, for a few days anyway, when we were able to do that successfully. But then they learned how to contain us better. So that sort of fell by the wayside. Or, you know, on March 9th, I think it was, when people were, ended up storming the Capitol, because it was locked down, like, maybe on the 3rd, mm-hmm. and, you know, of course, that went out on all, wires when they realized that there were, the Senate was executing a budgetary or a logistical maneuver so they could pass the stripped-down version of the bill, you know. I got word via just email, but, you know, that was on Twitter, that was on Facebook, get to the Capitol now. And then there were more traditional ways. I remember walking up, I was hurrying to the Capitol, and somebody was standing in on State Street near the Capitol Square, just yelling to everyone who walked by, "They're passing the bill now! Get to the Capitol! Go inside! They're passing the bill!" Just like, you know, like a town crier. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the cars started circling and just honking. This is what democracy looks like, over and over and over. And they circled the Capitol Square all night long, I think. But, you know, it alerted people, you know, check the news, something's happening. That was a really bizarre night. I think the thing that's maybe, you know, more important, though, is in the overall scheme of things was the... the use of Facebook in particular to communicate, to control messaging, and spread the word. What happened the first days of the protests was that, you know, the first day we were picked up by the, you know, the Daily Cardinal and Badger Herald, and you know, we even made the Isthmus on Valentine's Day, and we were all excited about that. And but then as this thing went national, you know, as the Journal Sentinel picked us up, Journal Sentinel, very conservative paper, Wisconsin State Journal, very conservative leaning, and, you know, they endorsed Walker, you know, they really bought into his, you know, his rhetoric and, I would say, lies about, you know, the condition of Wisconsin state budget and the deficit, which wasn't nearly as bad as he said it was. In the state media and in the national media, they began running all these stories that would say, well, lots of people, you know, we turn out 30,000 people, they say thousands of protesters or hundreds of protesters came to Wisconsin state capitol because their benefits are being cut. And then they put a quote by Scott Walker saying, oh, the state is broke, everyone has to sacrifice. But that's not the story, you know? And we all knew that intuitively. You know, we didn't know we didn't know what the story was, but that was clearly felt wrong, you know. And so, you know, in the first couple days, we're figuring out, well, what is the story? I mean, it wasn't about the bottom line. It was about, you know, it was about workers' rights. You know, if it were about the, you know, the 8% cut, you know, which is, you know, that's a hard cut, you know, especially for, you know, the incomes lots of state workers make. But if it were about the cut, you wouldn't have had all the people showing up. You know, people are mobilized about, you know, issues of rights, and they don't mobilize about, you know, benefits packages. You know, you could get a couple hundred people, you know, irate and yelling and stuff, but it wouldn't have carried the momentum it had. So anyway, back to the Facebook. So, you know, we were barraged by the national media, you know, running these stories, you know, that said, oh, you know, unions are angry, you know, it's, you know, the overtones, all that, oh, the unions have got to bust on a bunch of people to, you know, make noise because they want to get their, you know, fat dues money, you know, which is, you know, just a big crock of shit as far as I'm concerned, you know. The union bosses don't really make that much, you know. And so anyway, you know, we'd have, you know, days literally I probably spent on Facebook, and I'd never really used it much before even, but just posting stories and, you know, commenting, you know, it's not about this, it's about this, or, you know, look at this detail, they have this wrong, they have the facts wrong. Then we went and we would search for good data. I remember asking my friend William Banks, who he was, you know, Walker said, oh, we're in such terrible shape, the state, the budget, we can't afford anything, we're broke. And so I asked him to, if you could go through some numbers and look at the states, you know, individual state by individual state, and see where do we lie. And so then we found, I forget what it was, I think we're right in the middle of the pack, you know, it's like, we're the 20th best state for the economic situation, 20th or 22nd or something, I think. You know, and so when we started, like, showing this data, and we'd, you know, put it out, you know, on Facebook, and we'd email journalists and say, look at these numbers, here are the numbers, we're not broke, we're not in, you know, financial crisis, look at all these other states that are, you know, we're not great, but, you know, we're doing okay, we don't need to bust unions for this. And so, like, I mean, my own opinion, though, is, like, the whole media is so terrible, you know, so corporatized that, you know, it's ineffective. And, you know, they gave the same coverage, I believe, one of those weeks to, you know, 30 Tea Partiers in Washington, D.C., as they gave to, you know, the tens of thousands of people rallying in Madison, you know, and that's just not right. It's just bizarre, you know. So I think, you know, in part of it, you know, at the time anyway, I remember having this distinct thought about the media. I was so fed up with the Journal Sentinel and the Wisconsin State Journal. I vowed never to buy their papers again, you know, because it was so infuriating because they were just spreading what I thought were lies about us, and the media has been print media has been in decline for so many years. I remember thinking, you know what, maybe it's a good thing. We can do this, you know, on the internet. We can do this through Facebook. We're more effective. We've got better information. We don't have the corporate, you know, backing that, you know, gets to control what's said and what's not. You know, I was celebrating the death of newspapers for the first time in my life during the protests, because they weren't spreading good information, and the journalism was just abysmal. So anyway, I think that's kind of
okay.
I don't know if that makes much sense, or it's hard to frame it. It's kind of a big
right
issue.
So were you posting these things on a specific Facebook page or a specific Facebook event? How did...
Oh, well, I just had my personal one that I was using, you know, and getting information out to other people. Because I thought that, you know, I understood the issues fairly well, having been involved for a while. But, like, my friend Hillary, you talked to Hillary. Mm-hmm. You probably talked to her about the Solidarity Vigil.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I remember when she was asked me if she thought that would, if I thought that would be a good idea. I said, yeah, definitely, definitely. And that really exploded.
And in terms of, were you checking, obviously, I mean, Hillary's page, I think it started as an event and then
right.
turned into a page.
Right.
But were you you were posting on your page, but were you checking other people's pages and posts, either as they, well, I guess it would have to have appeared on yours. Were you doing that as well, or were you mainly just, you were getting a story and you were pushing it out on your page?
Well, I did everything I could think of, you know. I would, I was pushing stories out from my page, and usually Hillary would catch them and put them on her page. The event page, which had I have a few hundred friends or whatever, mm-hmm. but like, you know, she got thousands, I'm sure, and all over the country. So I know, like, I'm sure lots of my stuff went out that way. Various times I remember doing all sorts of things. I remember writing Chris Rickert from the Wisconsin State Journal and complaining bitterly about some of his claims that he made, and tried to tell him he was not understanding the issues very well. As much as I despise him, I even did tried to do messaging controlling on blogs at one point, you know, because, the little anonymous user feedback underneath the journal articles, boy, those are just, you know, hateful and vitriolic. But once or twice I went in there and tried to do some damage control when they were, you know, in the state media, when they were getting overrun by, you know, really kind of extreme conservative voices. So.
And were you doing anything in terms of social media specifically under the TAA bailiwick? I mean, you said they had a Twitter feed.
Let me think. No, I wasn't doing much of that. The Alex Hanna, you know, the co-president, he's really good with media stuff, and so he had most of that under control. I did a lot of their messaging work, I think. Not all of it. I wrote a lot of a handful of general membership emails to the membership, because I knew how to message, because I did it before. And then they signed their names to them, and they went out. Then I think it's just, I mean, I think lots of the battle the first week, because we knew, in the earliest phases, we thought, well, we can get these three vulnerable Republicans to budge on this issue, like Luther Olson, Dale Schultz, and Dan Kopanky. And so we're doing tons of phone banking to people in their districts. But the other part of the battle was being able to frame the issues in ones that intuitively made sense. You know, winning that rhetorical battle on a national stage, I think, for me anyway, I recognized by the third or fourth day that that's what we had to do, that the only way we can put pressure on, you know, on the legislators and on Walker would be to bring this to a national level and try to, you know, win the rhetorical battle, you know, that it's... That he's, you know, lying about things, that he's just union busting. Because, I mean, he was effective in the earliest days saying, oh, it's about the, you know, budget line. Which, you know, of course, he took that back later on. He said, oh, yeah, it really wasn't about the money. We really just kind of wanted to bust the unions. I forget if it was him or one of the Fitzgeralds that said that. but that's you know, winning the messaging war is the I mean, it's the key thing. If you can't do that, then you're in a world of hurt, because you're not going to get the public on your side. Then when we started getting feedback, when they started doing polls in state and national polls, and like by a 2-to-1 margin, people were opposing Walker's. It was like 65-35, I think, 62-38. People were opposing Walker's plan. Then we knew we were on the right track. I don't remember when that came out. In the first week, mm-hmm. they did polling, and same on the. It was basically the same on the national level, I think. That people were antagonistic to this. So then we knew that we were onto something big, you know.
I want to play off that a little bit, because you talked about winning the battle on the national stage.
Mm-hmm.
This is purely, I don't know if it's exactly it's an mm-hmm. opinion that I have. I don't know how many people share it, but it mm-hmm. seems to me that people on prominent politicians on the left, or prominent Democratic politicians, mm-hmm. Stayed away from Madison, or stayed away from this issue. I mean,
federal, like Obama,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, sort of the national, the two national names that come to my mind of people sort of with national prominence who came here were Jesse Jackson
mm-hmm.
and Michael Moore,
mm-hmm.
Neither of which are elected officials,
right?
So sort of a long introduction to a question about mm-hmm. How do you feel then about whether or not you got support from the larger elected officials? And if you want to talk about, you know, if you want to talk about sort of building out from local to mm-hmm. state to national.
Well, I mean, the state Democratic senators, the ones who left, you know, that was, I have nothing but admiration for that. That was really, you know, bold and courageous action on their part, and I think they're wonderful. I have enormous amounts of respect for all of them, some more than others, you know, but, and I was, just so proud to have people like Jim Holprin, he's a Democratic senator. He's from my home district up in northern Wisconsin, and you know, he's always had a rough go because it's, you know, a little bit right leaning up there, and but you know he hung tough and did the right thing, and you know, won a recall election, and you know, I just have all the respect in the world for him. But I got to tell you, on the national stage, I mean, it was incredibly disappointing. I mean, I vote Democrat, but they avoided Herb Kohl. He was silent. I mean, in my mind, that's just cowardice. You know, the biggest issue in his state. And I know it's a state issue, and he doesn't have to get involved, but, I mean, he wasn't even up for re-election, you know, because if it was already being revealed at that time that he was going to, this was his last term, and he just stays out of it, you know. Feingold, of course, was much better. He's good on all sorts of progressive issues. I was enormously disappointed with Barack Obama. Made campaign promises to, you know, in the event of labor unrest, to put on a pair of comfortable shoes and walk the picket line. I actually saw several signs mocking that sort of statement. They had pairs of sneakers hanging from picket signs and said, "Obama, here's your shoes, now come march with us." You know, he made a few comments, like two comments, I think, in the national media, but they were really wishy-washy. Honestly, strategically, maybe it was a wise thing, because he was vastly unpopular at that point, because it's before this campaign that's just been started, and, you know, there's a lot of, you know, and if he did get involved, maybe strategically that makes it look like it's being pushed by Obama, which starts to backfiring on a national stage. So, you know, strategically, maybe this is a good decision for him to stay away and make it seem, at least seem, worker-centered. But, you know, personally, I think it's, you know, reprehensible that, you know, you'll go and support labor unions in other countries and not stand up for, you know, workers' rights here at home. I mean, in my mind, it's pandering to, you know, corporate interests and, you know, I'd really like a real labor party in this country, and we just don't have. We've got some good politicians, but they don't gel around these issues. Even the state recalls, they didn't talk about this. So, you know, it's disappointing.
I would like to a couple more things, but since you mentioned it a couple of times now, I want to talk about or ask your thoughts about the August recalls.
Mm-hmm.
You know, basically how you thought they were going to go, how they actually went, and what you think any sort of either initial or maybe long-term benefit or lack of benefit from them. So basically just your opinion about the recall movement and then the recalls themselves.
Well, I was all in favor of the recalls. Not everyone I knew was. I mean, lots of the TAA folks are further left than me, and they think the whole system's broken, and it doesn't matter if you put in Democrats. But I still thought they were a good use of time and energy. And I remember, actually, maybe I don't mean to be too proud about this point. I think lots of people came up with this at the same time, but I was the first one in the people I was running with anyway, who's mentioned recalling the senators. Not like I came up with the idea, but I was talking to Paul Sickle. This was probably day three or something of the protest, and the recall walker signs were just coming up. And Paul Sickle, who's a staff organizer at MGAA, the Milwaukee Grad Assistance Association, I leaned over to him and said, so I was thinking, and maybe this idea is stupid, and maybe I just don't understand it, but, like, can't we recall the state senators? And he said, yeah, I was sort of thinking, you know, maybe that could be an option. That's a really good idea. So, yeah. But as far as the recalls went, I mean, I wasn't terribly involved with the recall process, but I think they went okay. You know, of course, it would have been nice to get Luther Olson out, because he was close. But I think it was the right thing to do. I mean, these were exceptional. I have many thoughts, I guess, because, like, personally, yeah, I think they're, you know, they should be recalled because I really strongly disagree with their politics. Two, I think the means and methods that they used to pass the bill were highly inappropriate. I mean, the way I see Wisconsin tradition is that politically you build consensus over time and don't make, you know, power moves. And through the process of, you know, public debate and discourse and building consensus for ideas, especially radical ideas, you know, radical changes like this, you know, I could have accepted if, you know, Walker talked about this on the campaign trail, if he talked about it for a year, put it to a vote, and then we lost. You know, that would have been a hard, bitter, bitter defeat, but I could have accepted the fact that, you know, Wisconsin people don't want unions. You know, crushing if that would have happened. But that process of, you know, would have been more okay with me. But, you know, trying to pass legislation in 4 days, radical extremist legislation, was just, you know, everyone involved with that should be, you know, told strongly that they cannot do that in Wisconsin. We used to have a tradition of clean politics, you know, and we need to restore that. So, overall, you know, of course, they didn't get the three they hoped for, but they got two. And when lots of people pointed to the data shift that happened. Like, there's like a 5% shift in each of these elections that, you know, all the Democratic candidates went up 5 points from the election the previous year, and all the Republicans went down about 5 points. And so that was in both the Republican and Democratic recalls. So the way I interpret that is that, you know, 5% of the voting population is across the state has kind of moved to the left on this issue. So that could, you know, have an impact, you know, for the next bout of recalls this next year.
What did you learn from the protests?
What did I learn? I don't know if I learned anything. I think well, there's something about the way it happened that you know, I didn't think such a thing was possible, because I've never really seen it in my lifetime, you know, on a sort of, I mean, I know that every 100 years or whatever, every 40, 50 years, you know, there are these, you know, social justice movements that kind of emerge and come and go. I was born in 78, you know, I never saw the Vietnam protests. And so, you know, I guess, you know, I learned it. Optimistically, I learned it's possible to do. But well, that's a hard and vague question.
Mm-hmm.
I learned Scott Walker's a douchebag, and I really don't like him.
Okay.
You know, Well, in all seriousness, though, I mean, disagreements aside, because I, you know, I can disagree with the politics and try to sit down and have a rational discussion with somebody who's conservative, and that's really important to me. You know what? You know that. I mean, like, it's really important to be able to disagree and compromise, and you know, come up with, you know, solutions to problems on a state political level, and you know, families and communities, you know, every sort of level. Being able to handle disagreement is, I mean, that's what our job is at the university, to negotiate, you facilitate discourse, and, you know, keep people talking. And so the tactics that he used, you know, not only just, you know, trying to slip the bill through in the dead of night without any resistance, you know, breaking their own rules to do it, you know, and just, you know, muscling power, being completely unresponsive to the, you know, largest protests the Madison's ever seen in numbers. And, you know, I mean, that's abhorrent to me. And beyond that, when these details from the prank calls come out, for example, that he planned to, you know, plant troublemakers in the crowd to discredit the movement, that he had conversations with other conservative politicians who openly encouraged him to stage a fake assault on himself, you know, plant someone to beat him up and have this plant act like a, you know, left-wing guy to discredit the movement. That's sick. The Deputy Attorney General of Indiana said that he should shoot us. He said, use live ammunition. I encourage the use of deadly force. That's really messed up. I mean, it's just, I can't wrap my head around that. You know. You know, when you disagree with someone, you talk it out, you don't shoot them. And, like, but that's, you know, that's what the modern, you know, Tea Party, right-wing, conservative bloc of the Republican Party is about. And, you know, that's just, I mean, it's not okay with me. And it shouldn't be okay with anyone, as far as I'm concerned.
I want to ask you to perhaps look into your crystal ball. Mm-hmm. We're going to, since we're interviewing you, you currently are a staff person and a still graduate student, but also a staff person here. What are, at this point, what are your future plans? First off, what are your future plans academically?
You know, with the job market so bad, you know, it's, I'm just looking for a job. You know, I'd love to teach someplace. I could get a, you know, it'd be nice to get a professorship someplace. I'd love to work at a, like, in-state Wisconsin school. But to be honest, the reality of the jobs in the humanities have been down 35% for two consecutive years. And now the UW is absorbing, you know, I think almost $300 million in budget cuts, and the net public dollars is the same as it was in, like, 1980 that we're getting. That's not adjusted for inflation. You know, I don't know if I get a job, you know, in the near future. So I'm preparing for the worst. But I would like to stay in the area and get a nice lower middle class job and hopefully have a career that's, you know, keeps me happy enough and pays the bills and can live in a place I want to live.
And what about politically? I mean, obviously, you know, I'm not asking if you're going to run for office, but sort of do you have plans to continue to, I guess I would say, fight this fight?
Yeah. Well, I mean, honestly, I think that there's different ways you can, you know, fight the fight, and it takes a lot of people to do it in different roles. One of my, you know, I might be what you call an activist teacher, you know, and I think education, you know, is one of these ways that we can, you know, effect change. And, you know, I think bringing these issues to students and being able to frame the issues in, you know, responsible, respectful ways is a really important part of, you know, the political activism process. In particular in K-12, which isn't my field, but, you know, right now, but I teach people who will be teachers, you know, by teaching at a university. Mm-hmm. I think it's important to get the issues, you know, framed in, you know, the right ways so that they're understood. Because, I mean, you've got the Texas Board of Education writing school books for all the kids, and they're, you know, talking about how great Joe McCarthy is, you know, like, and then saying, well, you can't talk about politics if you disagree with us. So that's a huge fight in and of itself. But, of course, living in Madison now, you're just more tuned and you have more opportunities to be effective in the political process and on the state level. But I suppose, I mean, I don't know where I'm going to be in a couple of years. I could be anywhere. But, yeah, I'm always going to be involved with unions and workers' rights and working class issues and these sorts of things, just because they're important to me. I think, you know, economic injustice is one of the, for years I've thought, economic injustice, the division of wealth have been, you know, probably the most significant problem our country is facing. And we've only made things worse in my lifetime, not better at all.
That actually reminds me of one more thing I want to say, because it's a, like, this is all current events, obviously. I mean, you could mm-hmm. argue this is all current events, but sort of current events mm-hmm. is the Occupy movement. Mm-hmm. And my question is, in your mind, did the Occupy movement, did what happened here in Madison in February and March have anything to do with these recent Occupy movements, whether it's Occupy Wall Street or some of the larger cities, or even some of the larger cities, not only in the U.S., but in mm-hmm. the world? So basically, what are your thoughts on that, particularly as it's very new right now, and who knows mm-hmm. what's going to happen to it?
Well, I think it has everything to do with it. I mean, not to say that the two, the Occupy grew out of Madison, because I don't, that seems a little self-centered. But I think there's a definite link in the fact that we've hit a sort of tipping point on the national level, that people are, I think a lot of people who have been indulgent of, you know, trickle-down capitalism are just, you know, more and more realizing that this economic policy does not work. We've tried it for 30 years. We're not doing better. We're doing a lot worse. And that everyone feels disempowered to, you know, affect these problems, you know, through the traditional political process. You know, when legislation cannot effectively, you know, control the control bankers, hedge fund managers, corporate executives, who just are able to, you know, out gimmick and out fox any legislation, you know, it gets to the point of absurdity. So I think on a national level, things have hit a tipping point, and we've got a whole generation of people who were told, if you do the right things, if you get yourself educated, if you work hard, you'll be able to get a decent middle class life if you work hard, and do all the right things. But you know, that's not coming to fruition for a lot of people. And so I think on a national level, there's quite a bit of, you know, outrage about these broken promises that society, you know, the country led people on to believe. And I think it is the inability to affect the political process that's causing the Occupy movements to grow as well.
Tim, are there... Now that we've talked, well, three times, but we've talked about 35 minutes this time, and I realize both of our memories are sort of fuzzy on what we talked about the first two times, but is there anything that you feel it important to get on the record as we wrap up here today?
Well... I don't know. I think the one thing that keeps coming to my mind is one of my friends, framed the issue to me once. New York had just passed the gay marriage law just a couple months ago. And, you know, I was like, oh, you know, that's good, you know, happy about that. And lots of my friends were going to New York to get married. And it's like, oh, cool, that's great. And he said to me, I don't mean to be a downer, but I'm just so sick of gay marriage. I said, what? And I said, because I couldn't even imagine that. And he said, no, it's all fine and good. But he said, I'm so tired of people who pat themselves on the back because they're, you know, socially progressive, you know, because, they think that their gay friends should be married, and they congratulate themselves on how, you know, leftist and awesome they are. And he said, that's like the easiest issue to get behind if you're a progressive. You don't have to do anything. You know, you can just say, I support gay marriage. And, you know, it's just to be expected. And now it's the majority of the population in the U.S. who supports gay marriage, I think. He said, but, you know, people don't care about, you know, economic progressive issues. People don't care about economic justice right now. You know, it's easy to get behind the social issues, but nobody gets behind economic oppression and you know, we're not doing anything for the working class. I've been saying this for years, and we have to do better. And I started thinking more about that, and it always seemed to me that, or it started to seem to me more and more like these economic issues need to get that sort of I mean, fashionable discourse, you know, they have to be chic, you know, in the national media. I mean, the people who are working with them need to make them not the old, stale, crusty unions, but, you know, it make it so, you know, strategically, so on a national level, if somebody's like, I don't know about these, you know, poor people, they probably deserve to get the low minimum wages that they get, that other people will look at them and say, really? Are you really that 19th century, you know, that you think that? You think that our society is good to poor people? You are really messed up, you know, and be able to, you know, chastise them on that sort of level. And maybe, you know, maybe it's a little bit cruel, but I mean, you know, it's worked with other, you know, social movements. You know, if somebody says something like, I just don't know about the black people, that people will call them on it and say, wow, that's not okay. So, and you know, this was all before the Occupy stuff started happening, and you know, maybe it's taking off. I really hope it is, that people are, you know, willing to speak up more for economic injustice. So anyway, that's about the best thought I have, I guess.
Well, it's probably not a bad thought to end on. So we'll chat here for a second after this. So this concludes the third interview with Tim Frandy. Thanks, Tim, for your time. Mm-hmm.